It's time to eat.
Get in my belly.
Sit down and get ready to consume an abundance of fantasy football knowledge from Ross Tucker and Evan Silva.
Me so hungry.
On the Fantasy Feast Eatin' Podcast.
Yeah, let's eat, baby. It is April, which means we are shifting this baby into overdrive, especially since we are in our first MFL 10 draft with you, the great listeners of the Fantasy Feast Eatin' Podcast. And when I say Eatin', of course, I mean EatinBlueApron.com. Absolutely delicious. The number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. We eat these all the time. I actually, we have a nanny for my daughter since my wife and I both work, and I have her make these for us. Delicious. Right now they got spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza, sweet and sour salmon, Parmesan crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine and roasted broccoli. Delicious. Here's the key point you need to know. It's affordable. There's plenty of variety. They can have flexible plans for whatever your needs are. It's very easy, and they guarantee to make sure it's fresh, or they will make it right. And get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/eatin. How cool is that? Evan invented Eatin, and now it's a code at a website, a big website. I love it. Here's the key. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Do not wait. BlueApron.com/Eatin. Legitimately delicious. And it's pretty healthy for you, too, which is awesome. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. How cool is that, Evan, that you just came up with this word or this, and even the title for the podcast, and now it's being used as a to get people three free meals at BlueApron.com?
I feel like I should retire. I should retire today. Should I retire?
That's the pinnacle, dude. You're never going to – I mean, you literally invented like a theme scheme word, and then it became a podcast, and now it's how people get free food. I mean, think about how many millions of people around the world that you are feeding right now with this code Eatin' that gives them – three free meals. By the way, whatever happened to the Travis Kelce nickname? Zeus?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It just kind of got old, I guess.
It kind of died, right?
Yeah, it kind of died. For a while, you know, on his Twitter account, he had...
I don't know. We should not have let that happen. We might have to reignite that.
Yeah, for a while, Ross, on Travis Kelce's Twitter account, he had like a cartoon picture of himself as Zeus, but that's gone now. You know, he's doing he did some like reality TV show. You know, we were early on him though, and we will always know that.
That's right. So we got Matt Wallman coming on. He's the man. Why did you want Matt on today?
Because he's a savant, and this is actually one of probably our longest podcast ever that we have done that isn't like a game preview podcast. And that's because we wanted to just suck as much knowledge and information out of Matt Waldman that we possibly could. And I love having Matt Waldman on the show. I think this is we will try to do it every single off season. Check out his draft guide, the rookie scouting portfolio. He's a wizard, man, and he's someone that I always, whenever Matt Waldman does a podcast, whenever he writes something, I always want to read it or listen to it because it's we're always learning, and this guy is a teacher.
I love it. Let's do it.
Big Eater of the Week.
Well, as promised and as always, we are joined by yet another one of Evan's stud analysts, although this one's a buddy of mine as well, the one and only Matt Waldman from the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, a guy you should all follow on Twitter, at Matt Waldman. And if you haven't already, you should absolutely pick up the Rookie Scouting Portfolio, his draft preview. Best place for that, Matt, is that mattwaldmanrsp.com?
You can find it there, absolutely.
Yep, Matt has an awesome, awesome draft guide every year. You've heard him on the college draft. He's been on the Ross Tucker Football Podcast before. He's also all over fantasy football. We wanted to pick his brain a little bit. I'm glad Evan did this because we are right in the middle, Matt, of an MFL 10 draft. And it's interesting because this is my first time doing an MFL 10 draft before the actual college draft. So before we actually know where these rookies, what teams they're on.
Right.
So, unfortunately, the other people in the league are probably going to listen to this, so they'll know any of the advice you give me, but who knows? I'm getting it first, so maybe my pick will come up before theirs. I look through and I see some of the guys that are ranked higher based on ADP, Fournette and Dalvin Cook and some of these guys. I guess let's start with running backs, Matt, and I'm sure Evan's going to ask you about specific players and your breakdown of them, but for a best ball MFL 10 type of league, without knowing what team they're going to be on yet, which running back do you think would be the best pickup right now in terms of having the kind of upside to really put up numbers that, you know, can help him score some points for me a few weeks at least in an MFL 10 setup, best ball format?
Yeah, and I think I'm going to give you the conservative pick and then the upside pick. And I think the conservative pick is Christian McCaffrey because you know that teams are looking at him in that Stanford pro-style offense and what he can do both in the passing game as a runner. And he's probably right now the most conventional fit for what the NFL is doing from a lot of its, you know, adopting some of its spread schemes, but also can run from the backfield, from the eye or between the tackles. And he's a guy that's going to be coveted pretty highly, I think, and it's going to get some immediate use. And he also has the least amount of, you know, off-field downside that you would be looking at among the four that are probably the most popular. I would say the biggest boom bust, but the one that I would consider is Leonard Fournette. After that is the risk guy, because while Joe Mixon and Dalvin Cook probably have their value as guys who could exceed what Fournette or McCaffrey do, Fournette has the least amount of off-field downside that is going to drop his draft status in the NFL draft. And on top of that, I kind of think that any team that picks Fournette, this is kind of an assumption of rational coaching, but I would think any team that picks Fournette understands what they need to do to use him well and make him more of a downhill runner, get him out of an eye or single back sets, minimize the use of shotgun with him, except with maybe certain teams that can run a little bit more power out of those types of sets and let him get downhill towards the line of scrimmage before he has to make a lot of moves. And to me, that's kind of like a team that screws that up, you're probably going to see management roll over the next couple of years. So I think a team that is probably not going to screw that up, and that means that he may have more upside than some of the things that, you know, people are kind of worrying about him that make him a little bit more polarizing than you would think for a top running back in this class.
I like it. In fact, I like it so much, I think I might ask you that at the other three skill position. How about a wide receiver? Is Corey Davis the guy with the most upside, or do you look at a guy like Mike Williams as a guy that's capable of having a bunch of touchdowns as a rookie?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mike Williams certainly has upside to be a starting wide receiver in the NFL, but I'm not as high on him as other people are. In fact, I kind of see his comp as more of a Dwayne Bowe type of player, where you look at the vertical, you look at the skill sets that combined with Deshaun Watson on the field, and I almost think that he'd be better off not in the way that they used him at Clemson, because I when I look at him play, I wonder if he's going to be as skilled at being able to win the ball in the air the way people are comping him to Alshon Jeffrey. I think he's more of a guy that might be better off on those tight slants and crossing routes, and where the ball is going to be placed to him in stride in ways that Watson wasn't quite as good at doing over the middle at Clemson, so that they used him a little bit more in the air. And I don't know if that game is going to project quite as well to him as people say. So Corey Davis, to me, I like his route running upside a lot more. I think that, you know, skill after the catch is strong. And I know that some people are, kind of look at him and say he might not be as good after the or good with the ball in the air, fighting contact and dealing with physical coverage. But I didn't see that. I saw a guy who I thought did a pretty good job of that, and has the mentality and the frame and to really win the ball in the air. It just depends, you know, sometimes when you look at the stats for those types of things, the way that's graded can sometimes be a little misleading. So I would say Corey Davis is really the slam dunk for me in terms of those two players.
All right. Okay. Now what about, I know that this is probably rare, but if you had to pick a quarterback, let's say it's a late round flyer that, who knows, you know, if he gets a chance to play, could have a couple weeks where he scores points for you. You know, I guess, you know, the more I see people like Evan Tweed, or I'm feeling buzz about like the Browns and Pat Mahomes. And I'm just wondering, you know, could Mahomes and Hugh Jackson's offense maybe have a couple weeks where he has some big games and puts up some numbers? Is there any quarterback that you think could potentially, you know, put up some points in a best ball format this year as a rookie?
Yeah, and I think that's a good example of Mahomes and the Browns as a fit, and we'll address that question first. And the best way to do that is, you know, you hear some of the comparisons between Mahomes and Johnny Manziel in some of the bad ways, but let's look back and remember that one of the biggest reasons probably that Johnny Manziel failed wasn't on the field, even though people were polarized about him. When he actually, the game against Pittsburgh, where it was the week after he got criticism for running around and doing a lot of improvisational type of play, he seemed to get it a little bit more together, and he had a strong statistical game, and he did some work in the pocket without running around at the level that everyone said he couldn't do. So what you see is a guy who was, I thought, pretty talented, who just didn't apply himself and didn't have the maturity to apply himself. I think Patrick Mahomes has some of that Manziel in his game without the off field. And that means that with those types of guys, you get that boom bust, high low statistical output early on in their careers, because, you know, we look at quarterbacks two ways. You have two broad ways. You have the guys who are kind of the book smart, scheme smart. I know every little detail of what I'm supposed to know, but they overthink things and they're not intuitive with their play. So the ball doesn't come out at the speed of instinct. They're not processing fast enough, and they're always waiting a beat or two behind. Kind of Alex Smith at his best, or at his worst at certain times now that he's been a veteran for a while. And then you have guys like Matt Stafford or Aaron Rodgers who have developed the book smarts to their games, but they still have that improvisational nature. And really the strong point of their game is that intuitive. Once I see it, it's there. The ball's out of my hand. And I think Mahomes has that quality to his game. He is one of the more intuitive quarterbacks. And that means for me that, you know, without teams scheming against him specifically for certain things, maybe early on when he first gets on the field, he will have a little more success with those improvisational plays, and that can give you some of that upside, both as a runner and a big play quarterback for you, you know, for a few weeks at least during the year if he's starting.
Love it. Okay, and then the last question that I have before Evan gets a little more specific is the same one I asked you for the other positions, but, you know, how about tight end? I know it's not a position for rookies usually, but it seems like this is a year where there's guys like O.J. Howard and Njoku that, you know, might be able to be your high-scoring tight end a couple weeks in an MFL 10 format. So is it one of those guys, or should I go with a guy like Evan Engram and think that maybe he could have a Jordan Reed-like impact for some team this year?
Yeah, and I think the latter is probably, if you're thinking just this year in an MFL 10, the latter choice is probably the better one, is looking at a guy like Evan Engram, or if Bucky Hodges is used more as a tight end in the way that Jimmy Graham was considered a tight end. I think those two guys would stand out to me as options because of the way that they make plays on the ball in the air, the speed that they have to get downfield, their skill in tight coverage. I think that both of those guys would probably be at the top of my list at this stage, whereas guys like Howard and Njoku would be good long-term plays and probably a little higher up on that board. And then maybe a late guy that you might want to consider if you're if you miss on those two, you know, slot receiver, you know, inline tight end type of players, as just maybe a total flyer would be Gerald Everett out of South Alabama, because the guy plays so smooth, former wide receiver who's physical enough that they may, if he lands with the right team, they may use him in the way that the Chargers wanted to use Ladarius Green early on. And I think Everett's kind of a guy who has a little more upside than what Green offered early on in his career.
I love it. Evan, you're up.
Awesome. Yeah, Matt, Pat Mahomes is a really interesting guy. I mean, people criticize his footwork, his playing style, like it being an improvisational, off-script, out-of-structure kind of quarterback. He played in an air raid offense, which I don't think has produced any successful quarterbacks out of that offensive scheme. Do you think that Pat Mahomes could play early in the NFL, even like start as a rookie? Because, I mean, the more that we get closer to the draft, it seems like he is going to be a first round pick. And while, you know, I think in an ideal world, sometimes these quarterbacks would sit in year one. These guys usually get on the field. So do you think that there is a scenario in which Pat Mahomes could succeed in year one if forced into playing time?
I think the answer is the odds for that actually happening for him to have success is low. I think the odds are below 50% for him to have that success, mainly because of that transition from the air raid to more pro-style sets. It depends on what type of set. I think if he's playing in more of an Earhart Perkins set, that you would see that the Cowboys use some of that, the Patriots use some of that, where learning it is a little simpler than learning the West Coast offense. Whereas, you know, talking to one of my friends and colleagues who's a quarterback coach by the name of Hewlett, Ryan Hewlett, who used to play at Stanford. When we talked about that, he talks about the West Coast offense being kind of like going from the air raid to the West Coast is kind of like learning Chinese, you know, as a language. And to me, that kind of says a lot about the whole Goff scenario going to the Rams, that he didn't seem ready. And I know there were some folks who talked about that as like it was a surprise. But the more that we look back in that in hindsight, I think that it makes sense that a guy having to learn all of that lingo and then time up his feet in with the routes in a little bit of a different way, in a more detailed way, you know, and working from a huddle, those are things that I don't know if I would necessarily say they're extremely hard to learn long term, but short term, packing all that in, plus the transition to the speed of the game and the complexity of defenses that they'll face, makes it more difficult. But the difference between a guy like Goff and Mahomes is that we saw with kind of Manziel, if you can buy time, you can improvise enough that you are oftentimes able to hit bigger plays. Or if you're paired with a team that if you're drafted later on and you happen to fall with a team where maybe the quarterback gets hurt and you're forced onto the field, but it has a strong surrounding talent base around him, he might not have to do as much early on. And if he can play disciplined football, which is the biggest question about him, is he someone that you can have him make more disciplined choices and not try to improvise to the point where he's putting his team in danger? Because that's the big thing that Dak Prescott did last year that was so impressive, is that he has all the physical skills to avoid cover, to avoid pressure and to be able to find players, and he had the arm. But you saw early on, at least for the first 5 to 6 games, where he was playing essentially a two-man, I'm simplifying it, but a very essentially a two-game man game with Witten and Beasley, often during that in that intermediate range within 12 to 16 yards of the line of scrimmage, and they were able to move the chains and settle for a lot of three-point drives, but keep the defense off the field. If Mahomes can play with that maturity, which I think is much harder than people understand, and why Prescott deserves so much credit, then I think he has a shot. But if he's winging around like Favre early in his career or Manziel early on, I think the chances in today's NFL are going to be lower. But I do think he is worthy of a late first round pick. I do think that he has the talent to develop. I just would love to see, again, in that ideal world where maybe he can have a year to really sit and learn.
And I wanted to ask you specifically about draft prospects that were polarizing. And Pat Mahomes obviously kind of fits that bill. Another one is Dante Foreman, who really only had 1 year of production in college, didn't really catch any passes. I think he played with a broken finger or a broken hand his final season. And he's 233 pounds, and he ran 4.45 at the Texas Pro Day. And that's going to – you know, a lot of people are gonna like that about Dante Foreman. What was your evaluation like of Dante Foreman as an NFL prospect?
Yeah, I think that when you look at Foreman, the promise as a runner between the tackles is there, and then you got to love the speed and quickness, because you can see it on the tape that when he bounces a play outside, he's generally smart about when to do so, and he has the speed to get the edge. And that's impressive for a guy of his size. And it appeared, I mean, it's hard to tell, but it seemed that he played a little heavier than he showed up at the combine, which makes it all the more impressive. The two big things that concerned me and dropped him on my board, because I had him in my top 10 of backs, but he wasn't in my top five. And what dropped him out of that top five is his ball security. It's awful. He has a lot of fumbles, and it's at a point where at the rate that you look at fumbles, it's the type of thing that would be more of a reserve caliber back in terms of when you tier that out into numbers and you kind of look at standard deviation of, say, the top 24 backs in fantasy football last year, and you take those top 24 producers and you sort it by ball security rate, not by production, but by ball security rate. And when you do that, his tier drops to a reserve caliber tier, and in terms of that fumble rate, and that's going to be an issue, because if he fumbles early on, you know how NFL teams are. They're not going to trust that unless you are an otherworldly top talent. And even then, you may get the certain coach who just isn't going to stand for it at all. So you have that. And then I did not see his pass protection as a positive. I know that I believe that PFF, Pro Football Focus, had a high grade out of him that I heard for that. But, you know, from the tape that I watched, I felt like technically he was not sound at all. I thought that he dropped his head way too early into contact, and he didn't, you know, he overextended too often. He didn't often get his feet where he needed to be so that he could be in position to actually deliver a punch. I didn't actually see him deliver a good punch that was technically sound, where he could, you know, have his feet in a good position and to work through the hips to be able to deliver that blow and then continue to move with that defender and either control him or at least even shield him. And I'm talking about linebackers and even defensive backs blitzing him, he had difficulty with. And so maybe he shielded those guys effectively so that the quarterback didn't get pressured, and that may have given him a higher grade. But when I grade it to my standard of looking at it from the pro lens, I think he's going to have trouble early on if he doesn't address this really quickly. And I think it's going to take him a little bit of time. So those two risk factors can keep a rookie off the field early on, and that's what drops him, despite the fact that as a pure runner, he has upside of a starter and a good one.
Curtis Samuel out of Ohio State is a player that I have started to see go in the first round of dynasty rookie drafts. And he's a guy that I had a tough time getting a grasp for and like envisioning in an NFL role. He's got great straight line speed. his change of direction, I thought, was at times a little bit of an issue. And I just really don't know what position he's going to play in the NFL. I thought it was cool that they would actually give him, like, traditional handoffs at times and, like, run him up the middle. And, I mean, he excelled there. And he certainly caught a lot of passes. I think he had, like, 74 receptions last season. How do you evaluate Curtis Samuel, Matt? And, you know, do you think that he's, like, kind of a coaching-dependent sort of prospect?
He very well could be, because we know that teams, if a team likes a player to be in a certain role, then that's where he's going to wind up. And they may see certain things that I don't. But I studied him both as a wide receiver and a running back, using different criteria that I use for each of those positions. And he actually had a higher score as a wide receiver for me than he did as a running back. And it's because, even though he may not be as polished as a route runner or getting off the line of scrimmage against, you know, press coverage and showing those type of techniques or having even the exposure to a lot of press, what I saw with him was the ability to bend his hips and to make sudden stops and turns. That's there. He just has to incorporate it more and learn really the fine points of running routes, getting greater depth on his stems, being able to make that, you know, that hard break so that you can come back and attack the ball. And it sounds like a simple thing, but, you know, Al Saunders, the great wide receiver coach who works with the Browns, you could see him at the Senior Bowl working with most of the wide receivers on their squad that week, pretty much every day, on lengthening their stem. And you could see the difference with players who were getting it. When they got it, they looked like almost completely different players because of the fact that they were forcing defensive backs to honor their speed and to turn their hips. And then you can come back, attack the ball, and you end up being able to attack it from with movement so that you can use momentum to turn up field and generate power and break that first tackle. And I think that when you look at Samuel, his game is a little raw in those respects of how to set those types of routes up. But some of the things that it's hard to teach is catching the ball in traffic and taking hard hits, winning the ball in the air against tight defenders. Maybe you can learn some positioning techniques with your routes to set up some of that. But being able to concentrate and make those types of plays downfield, he's able to do, and that's hard to teach. And in addition to that, being able to be as flexible as he is to bend his hips and run routes, the player that I saw as an upside comparison, and again, I would say emphasize as upside, is Randall Cobb. If a team treated him more like a future guy who could develop the skill set that Randall Cobb has, I think that would be the nice long-term look for him. But I can see how some teams might say, look, we need to get him on the field as soon as possible, and using him more as a Tavon Austin, Tyreek Hill, gadget type of guy who's going to be moved around the formation, and we can use him on certain set plays. That may give you the short-term return on some level. I don't even know if I'd say return, but at least the short-term use of him as a weapon that may help your overall offense on certain levels if you've integrated him well enough into the scheme. But I think there's higher risk for him not really advancing as a player, and also it not working as well, because it's easy to say that you're going to do that kind of work. It's much harder to actually execute in a way where defenses are forced to truly honor it in a dangerous way that sets up and helps your offensive scheme so it's not predictable.
Yeah, I wonder if the success last year of Tyreek Hill will actually help Curtis Samuel's draft position. I think that's conceivable. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Zay Jones out of East Carolina, crazy, crazy productive. And as was Justin Hardy, who came before him, but Zay Jones is a much better athlete than Justin Hardy. So coming from that East Carolina offense and with what we know about Zay Jones, do you think that he is someone who could get on the field early and contribute early? And what do you think that is his ceiling long-term as a prospect? Do you think he's just a slot guy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wasn't very high on Justin Hardy when he came out, but I am higher on Zay Jones than I was on Hardy, at least from, you know, the standpoint of what I saw and how I would profile his future. Because, you know, you look at Zay Jones, and some of the things that I liked about him is his quickness, you know, within those first 10 yards. And I think that he's quick enough to be able to get even with a cornerback and even get some separation on some deeper routes because of that. And I think a lot of his play and production obviously was based from him in the slot, but I think that had more to do with how East Carolina wanted to use him and to be able to get him the ball as much as possible, as opposed to maybe that he wasn't fast enough. Because from what I saw, I think he can get separation downfield. He is not the fastest guy, though, so he's not a guy that you would look at and say, you know, that he's an easy downfield threat on any play against any cornerback or any type of coverage. But at the same time, if you get him paired with a quarterback with excellent anticipation, a good anticipation thrower downfield, I think that he can be a solid wide receiver too in fantasy leagues long term. But to me, he's somewhere in that mix between, you know, and when I mention the players, folks may get hung up on how good they are, but I'm talking about at their best production or potential production. And I would say somewhere between a blend of Allen Hurns and the other Robert Woods, when you think of a type of player that he is, like fast enough to get deep if you have a good anticipation thrower with pinpoint accuracy, but a guy that is probably going to win for you more in the first 15 to 20 yards of the line of scrimmage and mostly on timing passes.
Yeah. Speaking of Robert Woods, he is a guy who landed in a great spot for target opportunity. I mean, the Rams, they're missing almost 300 targets from last year, and he's really the only, I mean, they just lost a bunch of guys, and he's really the only guy that they added. What was your evaluation of Robert Woods coming out of USC? And do you think that he could all of a sudden become a really high volume sort of receiver? Because he, you know, playing in Buffalo, that's one of the worst spots for wide receiver production, I thought. And it didn't really give us a good valuation of Robert Woods from a volume standpoint. Do you think he can be a high volume receiver for the Rams?
I do think that that's possible. I liked Robert Woods a lot. I liked him better than Marquise Lee. I thought he was a more mature player. And while he may not have offered that athletic upside that Marquise Lee had to offer, he was a player who played with more control, more maturity, more technique. And he was certainly athletic enough to be an NFL player who contributes in a starting lineup. So this is, I think, you know, from a narrative standpoint, you look at this and say, this is a big chance for both Woods and for Goff. Because, you know, there was talk at least this offseason that Goff tried to get together with some of his receivers, and the receivers rebuffed him and didn't want to meet with him and didn't want to schedule outside of, you know, working hours to do work. And then you wonder, you know, you have people who question his maturity and question also just his capability of being an NFL quarterback. But Goff, to me, has timing. I think he has capability of developing into a pinpoint accurate quarterback. And if you have a guy that you can trust to actually be where he's supposed to be, that's going to advance his development, because he's not questioning whether that guy's going to be there at where he needs to be in terms of route depth, with timing, being smart enough to be on the same page, or not smart enough, but more dedicated enough and focused enough to be on the same page in terms of reading what the defense shows pre-snap and then making those plays, you know, based on the rapport that they have and understanding through work and practice. And really, when you have that, can advance him a lot more. Because even when you look at a good example of this, I'm going a little bit farther back, but Carson Palmer at the end of his career in Cincinnati, when he had Terrell Owens and Chad Johnson, or whatever incarnation of Chad Johnson's name was at that point, those guys, you could see examples of them not running the routes at the depth that they needed to, not being on the same page with Palmer. And that showed up statistically. And a lot of people were like, Palmer's done, he's toast, you know, and he goes to Oakland. And certainly you have a lot of young receivers there, and they, you know, these weren't guys who most of them didn't turn out to stick with a team and become, you know, top-notch starters despite having the athletic ability. Now he ends up in Arizona, and you can see, you know, Larry Fitzgerald is not a guy who is, you know, he's known for running his routes and being on the same page with his quarterback and being a hard worker. So I think that if you – that hope with Woods being – if he's a hard worker – And Goff wants to work, and they work together, they could end up having a really strong rapport, because, again, it's about being where you're supposed to be. That's why Allen Hurns isn't a mega talent, but he was a guy who, when Blake Bortles was working at his best between year one and two and working hard in the offseason with Tom House, you could see that rapport and that connection that they had. And even last year, you could see the desire to get there. It just wasn't always successful.
And I wanted to ask you about one more veteran free agent and then a couple more draft prospect issues or players. Rex Burkhead. What did you think about Rex Burkhead coming out of Nebraska? You know, to me, in the pros, he's been a guy who just every time he gets an opportunity, he hasn't had many of them, but every time he's gotten an opportunity, whether it be in the preseason or, you know, last week 17 or in the second half of the year, just playing the passing down role in replace of Giovanni Bernard, he is taking advantage of those opportunities. What did you think of him coming out of college, and do you think that he has the talent to emerge as the Patriots' lead running back this year?
Yeah, Evan, I liked him coming out of school. And one of the articles I wrote on my blog was something I called Player B. And I had a Player A and Player B. And I didn't say who they were, but I showed their combine workouts and put them together. And the Player A turned out to be Kristen Michael. And Player B was Rex Burkhead. And basically what I showed was that, you know, when you look at the times that people tend to overlook, or the workouts people tend to overlook, you know, the 40 time, we always talk about how overrated it is, and then every year everyone's gushing over the 40 time. It's just kind of funny, but you look at that, and what I'd like to see the narrative kind of change to is people gushing over the 3-cone drill or gushing over the 20 shuttle, because those are drills that, when you talk about running back play, you want guys who can stop, start fast, or at least change direction fast, so that when they cut downhill, they really accelerate through that change of direction. And I think that those drills are a little more indicative of what makes a good athlete at running back, as opposed to the 40 time, where the 40 time basically tells you, if he gets into the open field and he gets past the linebackers, how likely is he to really give you another 30 to 40 yards and maybe even break it longer if he's running in a straight line? Well, how often does that happen compared to, you know, a guy who can take a 3-yard play and turn it into an 8-yard play, or turn it into, you know, even just a 5-yard play because of that one cut? And I would rather have a guy who gets me 5 yards, you know, I would say 4 to 6 yards on almost every play, even though he may not be able to break the 60-yard run. Than a guy who can break 60-yard runs if he gets outside, but most likely is going to lose you, maybe gain a yard or two, and more often than not lose a yard or three, because of the fact that he doesn't either change direction well, doesn't see the field well, that kind of thing. Burkhead has good vision. He's obviously a good receiver, and he was a player who I liked a lot for his burst and his utility. And he reminded me a lot of, and you look at his athletic profile, reminded me a good bit of Fred Jackson, the former Buffalo Bill. And
I liked it a lot. That's a guy who Belichick loved too.
Yeah. And he was a guy that wasn't very fast, but he was quick. He was big. And you know, obviously the Bengals liked him. Now the Bengals are an interesting case to me, because you know, for those of you who are longtime readers of the RSP, you know that I had a big man crush on Cedric Pierman, the back out of Virginia, who was, you know, who's been on the Bengals for a long time as a big time special teams guy, who I thought would be a better runner than he was in terms of production. But, you know, back in the day when Jay Gruden was there, they had to use him for a few games, and he actually had some good production. And they interviewed him and asked them about Pierman, and he said, "We didn't know what we had in him," which tells you that the NFL, oftentimes they get a guy, especially running back, and if he doesn't pop early on, or they acquire him because he's a UDFA, which that's what he was, an undrafted free agent, who was picked by the Ravens during the height of Ray Rice's career, and they didn't really need him, and he didn't show much in camp as a later pick, and he bounced around to a couple of teams before landing with Cincinnati and became a special teams star. So they always saw him as a special teams guy, and they literally said in their interview, "We didn't know what we had in him." Now, the Bengals in this time around with Burkhead were like, "We know what we have in him, but we couldn't get him ahead of the two guys that we picked early on in our draft." And I think the fact that Bill Belichick covets him tells you that he could have a nice role. And it may, to me, I think it says more about, honestly, it says more about James White to me than it does about LeGarrette Blount. I think, you know, the fact that Pat's Pulpit reported yesterday that they want Blount still, and that Blount is still interested in being a Patriot, tells me that Burkhead could have a bigger role, but I think that Blount will still be factor in pretty large for the Patriots if they agree, and I think that they will agree to some sort of terms. And that means that, to me, Burkhead's competing with James White for a larger role than what White has been able to offer up.
Love the Fred Jackson comp. That was a guy that Belichick, you know, he does these every week. He'll talk to the media and he'll talk about the players on the other team. And Fred Jackson was a guy that he repeatedly would bring up that he had a lot of respect for, and you know, for his all around game. And then when the Bills cut Fred Jackson in 2015. The Patriots were one of the first teams that called him. He wound up signing with the Seahawks, and it was kind of over for Fred Jackson at that point. But that's a guy that I know for sure Belichick loved, his all-purpose, you know, utility. Speaking of athletic testing, Dalvin Cook tested in the 9th percentile in terms of his spark athleticism, and this has caused, you know, a lot of differing opinions about Dalvin Cook's draft projection, maybe his NFL outlook. Do you think, this is what I want to ask you, Matt. So he showed great straight line speed at the combine. I mean, he still ran in the 4.4s, but the rest of his testing was pretty poor. Do you think that shows up on his game tape?
And it's such a great question. And the answer is it doesn't show up on his game tape. The combine, the poor combine workouts didn't show up at all. And I think that, again, it's about, we're still learning, you know, the analytics community is doing such a great job of being able to bring certain things to light and to, you know, help people see certain layers of information that can be useful to evaluating prospects or evaluating the game on a level that can produce actionable items. And I think the one of the things is that maybe sometimes people think that the analytics community has the combine figured out. I think it's still evolving just like anything else. And when we look at the running back position, I think we need to remember that, you know, we have prototypes for positions. You know, prototype for receiver, quarterback, linebacker, certain height and weight. When you look at the running back position and you say, what's the acceptable range of height and weight for a player to play running back, guys who've been successful in the league, even when you extend it to its outer limits, because, you know, we try to extend it to reasonable outer limits. You know, if Warwick Dunn is the reasonable outer limit on the low end, and Brandon Jacobs is the reasonable upper limit of dimensions, you're looking at like four different positions on defense, covering one position on offense. That, you know, when you're talking about player types and the style in which these guys play, you know, some of them are more straight line guys who make one cut. Some can make multiple cuts and make players miss, depending on the scheme that they're using, that they're going to be running behind predominantly, there are certain skills that they need to have more than others. You know, some rely on more on quickness and balance. Others rely more on strength and burst. And so it's, you know, it's a different type of, you know, it's a different, there are various different things that go into what a good running back can be. And a lot of it can also be based, that style can be based on their physical makeup. So when, so why would we apply the same set of workout measurements to each player if we don't know what their style is? You know, why would we compare Dalvin Cook to Jamaal Charles if they're two different style of runners? And what metrics really show more that are a reflection of what Jamaal Charles did best compared to what, you know, Cook or Brandon Jacobs did best? You know, it's just too wide of a range to honestly apply one set of numbers and say this number needs to be here, this number needs to be here for the same 250-pound back that you would do for a 210-pound back who runs with different styles. Because you're, again, not looking at the numbers in a way with context to say which numbers reflect the way this player wins, and can that player win with these numbers based on that style in the NFL. And when you look at Dalvin Cook, you know, one of the first things I did is I asked a guy I know who used to be a scout who does a lot of analytic work in the league, and probably one of the guys I trust the most from an analytic standpoint, and I said, what do you think about that? And his response was essentially, I've had a lot of questions about that, obviously, in the past few days, and I point him to his high school numbers. I point him to his Nike Spark camp, where he had a much better 20 time, but you look at his vertical leap, and it was still very low. And, well, did Florida State pull their scholarship on him because he ran because of that? And then, you know, some people might answer with that. You know, it's funny, but some people might answer, well, Florida State isn't the NFL. Very true. But look at Devonta Freeman's vertical. Look at Joseph Addai's vertical. You were going to look, there are a number of players, and Freeman to me is a good example of that because he's a recent guy who's played really well in the NFL with not a great vertical leap. And there are a number of guys in the league who didn't have great three cone drill times or you know, different 20 shuttles, and you can look at them in there, and there's some top-notch names there. And when you look at Cook's game, he's, you know, people talk about how elusive he is, but he's more of a run bender. He's a guy that bends his hips really well to kind of corner defenders, and he corners at a really high rate of speed. He runs with excellent patience and vision and anticipation, and his footwork is strong. He's just not necessarily a hard-cutting back. And people didn't have a problem with the fact that Tevin Coleman isn't a hard-cutting back. When Tevin Coleman is learning how to use his skills in a way so that he can actually, you know, use his athletic ability to match the scheme that he's been running behind, and he's developing more as a between-the-tackles runner. I think that Cook is a guy who is a much smarter, wiser runner than what Coleman was coming out. And when you look at his style, it, you know, some of the numbers I just don't think apply to him as much as, you know, is the burst enough for him to be an NFL caliber back on the field and produce? Yes. Could the three cone time be a little bit better? Sure. But, you know, he's quick enough, fast enough, and he sees what he's supposed to see and act on it with the speed of instinct. And when you play fast and you see things and act immediately, you are a much better player than a guy who that a lot of scouts call rep guys, guys who have combine tests out of the world, but unless you show them a million times what they're supposed to do in practice and that play goes exactly as practiced, they're not going to give you that high-end production. And Cook's the type of guy that when a play goes wrong, he still figures out a positive result, or it doesn't go exactly as planned. In the NFL, that's the mark of a professional, because things don't go exactly as planned on every play, if any play.
All right, and just real quick, this is my last one, Ross. I know we're going long, but we got Matt Waldman, man. We gotta pick his brain. Ish Zamora, just any thoughts on him? We don't have to talk about the off-field stuff, but just any thoughts on him in terms of his game film, and what were your takeaways from that? And do you think that he has an NFL caliber skill set?
Yes, so much so. And yeah, we'll put the off-field aside. And if you're strictly talking about his game tape, then he has a chance to be the best wide receiver in this class within 3 to 4 years. But wow. That comes with a huge but. The but is how hard he works on his hands. And that's a big one. Now, the thing is the reason that I make that first statement and then talk about hands, because hands are so important, is that he catches the ball very well with his hands for the most part. I mean, he can extend high. He can make plays in tight coverage after contact. He can dip low for a big dude and make some really difficult plays. But he has this tendency to catch the ball with the palm of his hands rather than his fingertips. And when the ball, your fingertips kind of act as little shock absorbers, and they're small. You have this kind of small surface area, and 10 places of small surface area to really stop that spin of the ball. And that's why when you look at hands technique, that the way they coach it, it's always trying to catch with the fingertips first and get both hands in a webbed type of position, because that stops the spin of the ball and controls it faster. If the ball hits the larger part of your palms, it has more of an opportunity to ricochet off, and that's how you end up fighting the ball. Well, he has an issue where he sometimes isn't catching the ball with his fingertips, and he ends up fighting the ball with his palms. That can be worked on. Quincy Enunwa was a player who had far worse hand issues than I had seen in quite a while. Sometimes I wondered if he was like doing interpretive dance with his hands and arms before he was trying to go up to catch a ball, because he seemed confused at Nebraska at times with, where the ball was arriving and how his hands should be placed. And he talked about last year about how his ascendancy really was due to him spending a good year at a jugs machine just practicing where his hands should be based on where the ball's arriving and tracking it, and that he worked diligently on that for a long time, and that his game kind of dropped off a little bit down the stretch last year because he stopped working on the jugs machine as much as he needed to in the middle of the year and then went back to it. And I think that you give Zamora a year on a jugs machine to really refine those fingertip types of catches, and you're going to see a guy who's got the speed, the size, to be kind of a Terrell Owens, Brandon Marshall kind of player, who has the speed to win after the catch and enough speed to get downfield and win the ball in the air. I really like what I see. He can bend his hips extremely well. So that also makes him a good opportunity of a guy to develop as a route runner. So he's not, one of my top 10 wide receivers this year, but in terms of upside, I could see the path to where he ends up becoming the best guy in this class if the off-field isn't a problem for him, and if he can work on his hands in this fashion.
Matt, you are the man. This was excellent. It always is. As you can tell, this guy has it figured out, or at least has a strong, strong take on all these guys. Can't encourage you enough to check him out on Twitter, at Matt Waldman. And right now is the perfect time to buy his rookie scouting portfolio. Just go to Matt Waldman RSP, rookie scouting portfolio, MattWaldmanRSP.com. Matt, thanks so much for the time.
Always a joy. Thank you.
Dude, Matt Waldman is so money. You know what else is money? Money, like actual money, is money, especially when you get free money, which is essentially what we're giving you over at DraftKings.com by getting you in on their free fantasy golf contest with $100,000 in total prizes up for grabs. The first major of the year starts tomorrow in Augusta, Georgia. You've probably heard of it. It's kind of a big deal. All you need to do is pick 6 golfers before the tournament tees off tomorrow morning, then sit back, outscore the competition, and win. Remember, the tournament starts this Thursday morning, like tomorrow. So hurry to DraftKings.com now, Get free entry in the $100,000 contest for golf's first major with promo code FEAST. That's code FEAST to play for free for your share of $100,000 in total prizes this Thursday only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See DraftKings.com for details. Speaking of details, you can always get in on any of these MFL 10 drafts that Evan and I are having right now. We're in the April one. In early May, we'll have the May one. We want to play against you. We want to see what you got. We want to see if you can take some of Matt Waldman's advice. So just take advantage of any of the sponsors that are up over at RossTucker.com. Send it to me, Ross at RossTucker.com, and you'll have a great chance to get in next month's MFL 10 draft, which will be right after the actual NFL draft, which will be awesome. Other than that, I think we're done here.
Thanks for listening to the Fantasy Feast Podcast. Make sure to also subscribe to the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, Even Money, and the College Draft Podcast, all available on iTunes at RossTucker.com or wherever podcasts can be found.
So I've been telling you guys about TrueCar for a while now, and what's amazing about it is as soon as my wife said, honey, I need to get a new car, I said, TrueCar. Because they have the information on anything that's been sold in your area. Think about it. 3 million cars sold, over 13,000 dealers, over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available, average savings of over $3,000 off MSRP. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. And here's the key. TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the car you want. Now you know what a fair price is so you can feel confident. Before we even started looking, she was looking at Explorers, Tahoes. I said, hey, look at TrueCar and you can find out exactly what other people have paid in the area. It is awesome. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. Plus, TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.